Welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. My name is Scott Linden. I'm your host, and I hope you will enjoy this podcast. As a listener, as much as I hope to enjoy it as a talker at you and sharing my thoughts and the thoughts of so many others from our community of like-minded bird hunters, dog owners, and that sort of thing. That's the whole point. If your season is on, I hope it's going well. If it's almost on, I hope you're counting the days, the hours, the minutes until it gets going. You and your dog and your friends and your family out there enjoying yourselves. That's what it's all about. Quite often on public land. So we're going to talk a lot more about that today, including a lot about the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, a relatively new organization that you might want to learn more about. I'll have Land Tawney, the executive director of that organization, on with me very soon to talk about that, who they are, what they do, and why you might want to join up. So stick around for that. But as always, several other items for you on the agenda, all brought to you in part by Cabela's. They're the official outfitters of the Upland Nation podcast. In our public land sequence, later on in the podcast, we'll talk about grouse hunting in New York. You know, have kind of neglected the Northeast a little in those, this land is your land features. So we're going to cover that. And then in our Handle It segment, all about dogs, a first-person account of something that I think needs to be said a little bit more strongly. So pay attention for that and how your hands influence your relationship with your dog. So stick around for all of that. Well, the good news is the weather's cooled. There's been some rain out here in the West. It's tamping down some of the fires, but we've still got millions of acres that are flaming here in Oregon, Washington, California, even in Nevada a little bit. So if you can help out in any way with some of the folks who are having problems there, please do pitch in. It's pretty crazy. But at least the smoke has gone away around here, so we're back to our regular training regimen. Yeah, I was worried about it for a while there because, dogs are, professional smellers. And all that smoke, if it's so bad, the doctors are telling, viable young adults to stay inside. Imagine what it's doing to a dog's sense of smell. So anyway, we're doing fine. Flick's doing great. How about your training if you're still in that mode? Or how is your dog doing in the field? I love our Monday morning debriefs on the Facebook page, getting great pictures and great accounts of whatever you did over the weekend. So keep those coming in. Check that out every Monday morning on the Wing Shooting USA Facebook page. Speaking of electronic communications, I thought I'd bring this one back up because it's timely, if nothing else. And that is, every week in the Weekend Essentials newsletter, I do a poll. And a poll I did a while back I never really talked about here or shared in the next newsletter, which is what I do there. I asked, what is your bucket list bird? And I guess I shouldn't be surprised at some of these things, but I am by one in particular. Yeah, everybody wants to shoot a pheasant. Yeah, according to the numbers, at least 36% of you put that at the top of your priority list. Interestingly, though, second on the list, sage grouse. Over 19% of you have said that that's your number one priority when it comes to filling your bucket list. And that I'm not surprised at that in a lot of ways. There's so many factors involved with a sage grouse hunt. The first is dwindling habitat. We won't go into the politics of that until Land Tawney joins us. Maybe we'll talk about it then. But there's also, states that are talking about or even doing something about preventing you from hunting them. So yeah, if you're going to chase a sage grouse, you might want to move that up a little bit higher on your list and check out all the results and get on that email newsletter list by signing up at findbirdhuntingspots.com. Yeah. Yeah, the Upland Nation podcast is brought to you in part by Sage and Breaker Gun Care Products, crafted at the highest caliber. I learn something every time I go on to their website, including some of my own writing there. I write a column for them every month, and you can dig into the blog posts there and read that. But the videos are increasingly informative to me, especially as we start using our guns more frequently. So take a look at sageandbreaker.com and then dogtra.com. Learn more about the T&B Duel, all the discounts there. I'll have more information on all of that. Check out the new extended, what do they call those things? Those new, for long-haired dogs, they call them enhanced contact fins. I know it sounds kind of space age, and it is, so check it all out at dogtra.com. All right, so here we are on the line with me right now from somewhere in the great state of Montana. Lan Tawney, welcome to the program. I'm glad you could join the Upland Nation podcast.
Oh, man, I'm so glad to be here. Happy Friday.
Yeah, and we are recording this, actually, what's really interesting, and just sheer coincidence, tomorrow, Saturday the 26th, is National Public Lands Day here in the United States, and so it's propitious for any number of reasons, and we'll get into that and the organization, the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, for a lot of reasons, some of them close to home for both of us. Doing some research on all of this, a name came up that I hadn't seen for a while, Tim Lillibeau. I don't know if you see Tim every once in a while. He was instrumental in the founding of this organization way back in the day, and a gym buddy of mine way back in the day.
Small world, man. Yeah, he was at the original campfire, the famous campfire in 2004, where they actually formed this organization.
Yeah, he's a great guy, and he's for anything in the world of public lands, that guy is always around somewhere. And then your background, raised in Montana, you hunt and fish, you got a degree in wildlife biology. You also worked at the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, an organization I watched from its inception, when the last word in that title was alliance instead of partnership. That was a very exciting thing back in the day. And I know they work in parallel in many ways with you, but they also have their own agenda, and everybody else does too. So let's talk about that first. Let's talk about the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers and what your real goals are.
Yeah, that's great. So when those folks were sitting around the fire, you know, there were seven of them, and Tim was one of them. Mike Beagle was at his house, and they were looking at the playing field of all the organizations that are out there. So, you know, the Pheasants Forevers of the world, the Ducks Unlimited, the Elk Foundation, the Mule Deer, Trout Unlimited, all, you know, organizations that are doing amazing work, but nobody was really focused on public lands and public waters, and in particular, those wild places that, you know, provide the adventure, the solitude, the challenge. And so really they formed this organization to make sure that you have access to public lands and waters, and then the quality fish and wildlife habitat when you get there. And, you know, a lot of organizations really work on, you know, purchasing land, you know, for winter habitat or for breeding habitat. And really what BHA does is we work more on policy, and at a local kind of state and provincial level, and then all the way out to Washington, D.C. And, you know, our members, you know, again, they want to get involved in that process. And when you think about, you know, overarching things that happen in D.C., that has huge implications for everybody in this country. When you think about, you know, regulations that are made at a state and kind of local level, that impacts, you know, your backyard. And so really the impetus of the organization was to really be engaged in those processes. And so the hunters and anglers are at the forefront, which they have been, you know, for a long time. And, you know, in the meantime, since that kind of original campfire, it's also, you know, the stewardship has become a major piece of the organization. So on the grounds, getting your hand dirty, you know, this month is Public Lands Month. and we have a goal of picking up 1,000 bags of garbage, and we're on the precipice. By the way, it's Public Lands Eve today, right? It's Public Lands Day tomorrow. But we've got almost 1,000 bags already picked up, and there's going to be a bunch of events this weekend, so we'll surpass that. We've been doing riparian zone kind of restoration, and then we also have a kind of recruitment, retention, and reactivation program, and that really focuses on people from really 20 to 40 years old. And, you know, people that didn't grow up hunting, that really want to get into hunting or want to get back into hunting, with the majority of them wanting to source their own meat. And so we run programs all over the country, getting folks engaged, in hunting, and from, gun safety all the way to how you process that meat and then ultimately cook it. So I could talk all day about other things maybe we're doing, but I think the gist really is that we want to focus on, big policies that affect hunters and anglers when it comes to access and opportunity, as well as fish and wildlife habitat.
Well, you're in my wheelhouse in all of those regards. Number one, every year I survey my followers, and their highest priority is finding new public land to hunt. And you guys do the same thing, I'm sure. And so it works. What you're doing is going to help in any number of ways. And then the whole recruitment thing, of course, is critical for any number of reasons. We don't need to go off on that tangent today, but it is important for, the future of the habitat itself, but also for the sport that supports the habitat. Let's get down to the more important stuff right off. If you're going to do anything at all, is it going to be hunt or is it going to be fish?
Oh, it'll be hunting.
Big game or small game?
Birds.
Okay. Upland or waterfowl?
This is where we might diverge a little bit. Waterfowl. Waterfowl is, I've grown up with black labs, and waterfowl hunting is just, if I could only do one thing, I think that's what it would be.
And why is that, Land? Everybody has a reason. I'm always curious. It's kind of an informal survey. Why do you love it so much?
I think there's a couple of reasons. I think it's first, that when I was a young kid, my dad brought me to the duck blind early on, and it was before I could shoot. But I remember kind of that thunderous eruption of, a bunch of birds on the water as we, set up decoys in the morning, and then watching those come back in fours and fives, watching the dogs work. I think I fell in love with it then. And then I will say, particularly with my lifestyle right now with two young kids and a job that is very demanding, I can get out and go waterfowl hunting, in the morning before work, or, for a short time on the weekend, and still do stuff, either work wise or family wise. And, it's another thing I can also engage my kids in. My kids are getting more mobile, but they can't elk hunt yet. Right. those steep mountains, just aren't conducive to those little legs. And so, waterfowl hunting, man, it's like probably the convenience a little bit, but it's also just that trick in birds and the way the marsh wakes up in the morning and watching the dog work. That gets my juices flowing, I would say. And I got two more weeks before I can do that.
Yeah. But in the meanwhile, you'll content yourself with some blue grouse and rough grouse somewhere.
Oh, absolutely. And I've been doing that since September 1st on our opener, and it's enough that one, my kids can definitely come along. And my son, who's 9, he won't put on pants for some reason. He likes walking in the brambles with shorts on, and ow, he looks at his scars on his, or scratches on his legs, and thinks that those are battle wounds that he is proud of. But he's been with me. My daughter's been with me. The whole family went last weekend. So, the upland, stuff, especially in the mountains, going after grouse is a lot of fun.
I love it. You're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. That's Land Tawney. He's the president and chief executive at the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. I'm Scott Linden. I'm a backcountry hunter and angler, and I want you to define that for me, Land, because, a lot of people think that means some guy with a backpack and all camoed up and walking 4 days into the wilderness to shoot an elk and then carry it out over the next 6 weeks. But how are you guys defining backcountry for us?
That's great. So I would say it definitely includes that. But really, I think it's, any kind of piece of public land and waters that you can get to that really, again, provide that kind of solace, the solitude, the adventure, and challenge. And, I know that when I get on water, in particular when I'm fishing, and, I may have a highway close to me in places, but that whole world disappears behind me and I'm focused on the fishing and I'm really present in the moment. And so I think, you know, backcountry is probably more of a state of mind than anything. And, you know, when I think about, you know, the marshes of the southeast, when I think about, you know, some of the national forests in the eastern part of the state, when I think about the vast amount of public land that we have here in the West, like there's all sorts of different pieces of that public land experience that is your backcountry, right? And I think that your backcountry is really defined by you, but, you know, we like doing it on foot or on four legs, you know, really letting the feet do the walking. And on those places that are big wide opens, you know, some of the places that I can go hunt sharptails, I could walk for days. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that to me is a piece of backcountry, just like it is, you know, the middle of the Bald Marsh Wilderness here in Montana where I hunt elk.
Well, that's good to hear because, you know, as you well know, you know, most of us bird hunters, we're driving somewhere, then we're parking and then we're walking, but we're not going in for 3 weeks. We're going in for 4 hours. And so now we feel a little bit more included than we might have otherwise. About how many of your members are actually primarily bird hunters?
That is a great question. And man, I wish I had that at my fingertips. We just did a membership survey and I should have that on my fingertips. I know that it's 85% of our members hunt and fish.
Yeah.
And so like, you know, it's not, I mean, I think a lot of our members are just like me. You know, you asked me early on if I could only do one thing, what would it be? And I went to waterfowl hunting. But, you know, during the spring, like in June, I'm, you know, fishing the salmon fly hatch, and then I'm picking huckleberries. And then I go into hunting grouse, and I go into hunting waterfowl, then on to antelope, then to big game, then more, I would say, upland birds and waterfowl until the first of the year. Then I get into ice fishing. Then we go into spring the next year, and I'm, you know, fishing the squalla hatch early in March, and then getting into morel mushroom picking. And so like our members, I think, are, again, a lot like me, and we do it all. And that's what the, I mean, I think some of the great opportunities that you have on public lands and public waters is there's just a plethora of opportunities. And I call it like an embarrassment of riches that we all have, right?
Yeah.
And we try to take advantage of that.
And again, we're on the same page. Most of the bird hunters that I have as friends and followers, if you will, are doing something else, you know, in their off season, if you want to call it that. So your organization, let me just put it this way. Beer seems to be a high priority. And I'm okay with that. I'm a home brewer. I got a book deal to write about beer real soon.
Awesome.
And I get it. So explain how you're engaging the younger demographic first, and then we'll keep going on that.
Yeah, you know, I would say that if you go back to like the early parts of the kind of the 20th century, so early 1900s, and you know that's when like these rod and gun clubs start popping up all over the country. And in the 30s, you know, they were like very, very strong, I would say going into the 40s, 50s. And these are these local like community gathering places. And not only, you know, were they talking about hunting and fishing, and a lot of them had like gun ranges along with that, you know, they were working on policy as well. And mm-hmm. that was really the power and bringing all those together, which I think, you know, in 1930, what was it, 8, that they had the first North American Wildlife Conference, and they all came together, and maybe it was 36, and formed the National Wildlife Federation. And that was basically all these small groups going to state groups and then also ultimately going to this national group. So highly successful model. But as those folks, you know, as things have changed with all the species groups, like we've kind of gotten away from these local kind of rod and gun clubs. And we have pint nights and basically bring people together, you know, at a brewery and have conversations over a beer or two that, you know, range from stories to laughter to serious stuff about conservation. And it's been a great way to bring our community together. And, you know, a lot of people think, you know, oh, you guys just get together and drink beer. Well, yeah, we drink beer, but we also engage on the latest kind of policies, and ultimately this is what helps form our, you know, our chapters and volunteer leaders that, you know, that are getting engaged at a local, state, and then federal level. So that starts with maybe a beer, and that's where good conversations can happen. And then I would say that we go into many other things besides that.
Well, let's go into those many other things. I mean, let's talk about how you're organized. You look at the map on your website, and most of the states and many provinces are a different color than a few of them. So tell me about the growth and where you are. What is your footprint these days?
Sure. So about 7 years ago, we had a handful of chapters, about 1,000 members. And then today, fast forward to 2020, we've got chapters in every single state besides Delaware and Hawaii. So anybody listening from Delaware and Hawaii, we'd love to get that going. And I will volunteer for Hawaii in a second to come check it out. But then we have 40,000 members. And so those 40,000 members then all belong to either a state or provincial or territorial chapter. And so these chapters then have a structure of volunteer leaders that are usually regionally spread throughout the state, that are in charge of kind of policy and events and then recruitment, retention kind of stuff that we do. And really, you know, the way we work, Scott, is that our members on the ground, we're truly a grassroots organization. And so, you know, while we have some sideboards on what we, you know, suggest that they work on, really it's up to the local chapters to, you know, to work on what they want to do. And a lot of times they'll come up with even an idea. Right now, again, I've talked about kind of this trash we're picking up this month in Public Lands Month. That started with our chapter in North Carolina, who had this trashy squirrel pickup where they were picking up trash and hunting squirrels at the same time, and then gave away this squirrel trophy, which was a stuffed squirrel. So we looked at that idea and we said, you know, our members are all around the country. They're picking up garbage all the time, but let's make it kind of a contest, kind of a campaign. And so that's what we're doing in the month of September. And really our chapter leaders, you know, they're absolutely amazing. We have over 700 now chapter leaders spread across, you know, North America. And to me, that's the heart and soul of this organization.
Well, you know, when you talk about members, and we understand everybody pays their dues and all of that, but that's nowhere near enough money to fuel an organization like yours and some of the things you're doing and the broad scope of work you're doing, particularly when you work with lobbyists in, you know, within the Beltway. How Sure. else are you funding the backcountry hunters and anglers?
Sure. So speaking of lobbyists, we do have our own government affairs person in Washington, D.C. Her name is Julia Peebles. She's absolutely amazing. She used to work for the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, like I did, and came to work for us a couple years ago, and she's absolutely amazing. But funding. So, again, when I first got here about 7 years ago, I would say 90% of our money came from foundations. So foundations that, you know, care about public lands and public waters and wanted us to succeed. We still enjoy about 45% of our funding comes from those foundations, which again, you know, that helps us get stuff done on the ground. But then you have membership money, and then you have corporate partner money. We enjoy a bunch of great corporate partners, ranging from like the First Lights of the world and the Sitkas. We just picked up Yukonuba, Yeti. I mean, a lot of bigger names, I would say. Weatherby, we're working with them on a lot of shotguns. And so corporate partners is one. Events, you know, which has been tough this year for us. You know, these pint nights don't generate a lot of money. But the other events that we do are, you know, we do like storytelling events. We do some wild game cook-offs. And like do some film tours. We worked on a public grouse this last year with Project Upland. And so those events have stopped. And that has been, you know, difficult for us this year, though we've really pivoted into a lot of virtual events. So I'd say events is another source of funding. And then one that we haven't totally developed yet, but is starting to grow is really kind of individual donors. And when you put all those things together, you know, that's 100% of our funding. And it's very diversified, I would say. And in the case of COVID right now, I'm thankful for the foundation money. I'm thankful for the membership money and our corporate partners. And then, you know, we're trying to get creative with events.
Well, good luck on all of that. I know everybody's facing the same challenges. We've had many of your colleagues from other organizations on the Upland Nation podcast talking about how without a banquet season, you know, they're dead in the water. And so anybody out there who's contemplating joining the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, this is a good time to do it and help fuel the, you know, the entire scope of work they're doing. Lan Tawney is the president and chief executive. I'm Scott Linden, the president and chief executive here at the Upland Nation podcast. Lan, you get a moment here to sip another coffee while I make a couple commercial announcements and then come back and stick around, everybody, because in addition to all of that, I'm going to be relating a personal story for our Handle It segment. So, Lan, take a break. I'll be right back to you while I'm talking about Dr. Tim's performance dog food. Dr. Tim, of course, is Tim Hunt. He's a veterinarian, among other things. Understands performance dog food like nobody else because he's doing it every day when he's competing in the sled dog racing world. First thing you should know is you get a 30% discount on your first order when you use the code UPLANDNATION. Yeah, they'll deliver just like all those other guys, but Dr. Tim is a supporter of the hunting community, and unlike some of those other pet food delivery services. So learn more at drtims.com. Dr. Tim, still selling you 40-pound bags. About once a week, I'm reminded of how heavy those things are, but I don't mind because I'm getting great value from Dr. Tim's performance dog food. And I'm getting incredibly better hearing protection than I've ever had, thanks to Jack Homa over at ESPAmerica.com. Four different choices for your budget, and they're all custom-fitted electronic hearing protection. They're waterproof as well. And don't forget, if you're one of those guys who's wondering whether you really need it or not, Jack offers a 30-day money-back trial. Get fitted locally in your own community. Go to the dealer locator page at ESPAmerica.com and learn all about your choices and all about the reasons you should protect your hearing. Got it? Good. All right. As usual, the Handle It segment is all about the things I learn about dog training and care the hard way, so you don't have to. I was going to talk about this anyway, but something happened last night that just drove the point home even more. Think about your hands and how you use them with your dog, whether it's that tailgate exam I talked about last week, or how you use it for training, or how you use it to groom your dog, or doctor your dog. And this is what I'm getting to. We were celebrating the soon-to-be opening day last night, and there were two of us, and our dogs were playing together, and my dog took a stick and broke it up and ended up having part of that stick lodged between his teeth, you know, across the top of his mouth. Now, how does that relate to hands? Well, if your hands have been used to hit and discipline your dog, how are you going to doctor that dog? How are you going to groom him? How are you going to check him after a hunt if he's fearing those hands? Luckily, I don't do that. I leave those functions to the e-collar, my voice, and a check cord. And it was brought home to me again last night when my friend John and I had to hold that dog still, and John had to shove his hands into Flick's mouth and pull out that stick before Flick gagged on it, before he went drove us crazy. So remember, hands are friendly and welcoming instead of a disciplinary tool when it comes to bird dogs. If you need a bigger scare than that, then just give your dog the wrong sized stick and then try and get it out of his mouth when it gets stuck there. Be kind to your dog. Use all those other things for discipline instead. And Land, thank you for your patience. We are done with all that stuff, and I hope you are back with me. Lan Tawney, president and chief executive at the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. You there?
Alive and well.
Good. You ever had a scare like that with your dog?
I think my biggest one was probably an older lab of mine that got into a porcupine. It got some porcupine quills in the back of its mouth.
Don't get me started.
I would say the same thing, right? Like with that dog, it was e-collar and voice.
Yeah.
And so, the go in there, with the pliers and put my hand way in the back with the pliers and grab those things out was absolutely essential. And then my dog I got right now, it's sitting right next to me. It's my first female, and man, it's just my voice. I haven't had to use anything else. She's pretty attentive to me, which has been awesome.
Oh yeah, and count your blessings, and that's absolutely correct. All of the above, and there's a perfect example of it once again, everybody. So, let's talk a little bit more about backcountry hunters and anglers. And here's a question that has been. Since the inception of your organization, and again, I've watched you since the very beginning, Carl Findling. Carl's a friend of mine and colleague out here in Central Oregon, and he was there from probably day two, if not day one. While your member demographics are skewing slightly lower, younger, if you will, than my followers, we're still welcome in your organization, right?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. And I will say, I think people always ask, why is BHA being so successful and why is it growing so fast? And I think a huge part of that is combining the sage wisdom with like youthful exuberance. And, I think that, 70% of our members are 45 and younger, only 6% are 65 and older, which is drastically different than any other of our contemporary organizations, both in the hunting world and I would say the conservation world as well. And when I, talk to folks that, have been around for a long time and see the energy, like it goes both ways, right? So if you've been involved in conservation for a long time, and man, like things just don't seem to be going very well, like there's less and less people coming to meetings, and all of a sudden there's this influx of younger folks. Not only does that give them energy, but it helps them pass along the knowledge that they've learned for a long time. And so I think it's an amazing combination, and our folks with wisdom welcome this organization. I would say absolutely yes. And I turned 45 this year, so pretty soon I'm going to be out of that cohort of 45 and younger. And I look to that next generation, like how lucky are we that somebody else is coming in our footsteps and are going to fill our shoes.
You bring up a really good point. I see this on the local level a lot. And now that I'm an official OG, I'm a little bit more sensitive to these sort of things, but there's so much accumulated knowledge and then simply the cultural aspects that are stored in this library of human beings that may be older than your typical member there. And it's nice to hear of an organization that recognizes that there's some value to that, because frankly, it doesn't happen everywhere else. Now I guess I am a real old guy if I complain about that sort of thing, but are there efforts, or is it an informal process? You put two dogs in the same field and they're going to work off each other. Do you do more than that, or do you just turn them loose and turn the collars off?
I think it's somewhat informal, right? And I think we have a lot of folks, and some of that knowledge base is either they're former Forest Service employees or U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service employees, and so they know how the system works, or they've been involved in conservation and so they know how the system works. But I would say it happens in a couple of different ways, is that leadership within our chapters, there's opportunities for those that have, been around and know the ins and outs to help teach some of the younger folks, that are up and coming leaders. So that naturally happens there. I would say our chapter coordinators in particular, who are on staff, they really look for that kind of leadership development piece and opportunities to have, mentors and have folks take them under their wing. So I think that's working really well. And then I would say, like when we do stuff at the state legislatures or even out in Washington, D.C., having that combination, for somebody that's never been, has never gone to testify in front of a committee or has never gone into those, scary rooms in D.C. with staff and maybe even a member, they can be pretty intimidating. And so we really try to combine when we do things like that, have, you know, folks that have experience to those that don't, and so they can learn from each other. And so far it's working amazingly.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And yes, I know that feeling. I've given testimony, written testimony, and been on the other side of that as well. There are a lot of groups out there, and they all have something going for them. And you know what I mean? There's the critter groups, there's the, the land-based groups, and then there's you guys and a whole bunch of others starting from way back, like you said. How do you guys, is there a reason for you, or do you I use the word compete because I'm not very good at this stuff, but at times it appears like you're all trying to accomplish different things in different ways. And then at other times you're all focused on the same thing. And I'm leading towards the Great American Outdoors Act in a moment, but do you guys get together and figure out who's going to play first base and who's going to play center field?
It depends on the issue, I would say.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, there is joint planning that happens all the time. And, you know, again, like what we have is a grassroots constituency that is fired up and ready to engage. What's different about BHA, you know, besides kind of the habitat work that many other organizations do, is that, you know, not only we engage people at a grassroots level and help them make phone calls or go to meetings, and engage in these kind of policy processes, is that we also, you know, from a headquarters standpoint, we call it like we see it. And so when, you know, a politician does something good, we applaud them. The next day, if they do something bad, we'll hold them accountable. And, you know, both, I think, are very important. It's just like training a dog that, you know, when that if you let that dog get away with something, you know, for too long without saying anything about it, then that's going to be a habit that's going to start, right? And so I think for too long, the sportsman's community has been very reticent to hold public officials accountable, especially publicly. Some of that happens behind closed doors, but I think it's way more effective when it happens out in the eye of the public because there's a lot more pressure there. And so here at BHA, again, you know, I'll give you an example in the lead up to this land and water, you know, into the Great American Outdoors Act, which includes the Land and Water Conservation Fund, is that the president, you know, comes out with a budget every single year on, you know, what he would like Congress to do. Ultimately, Congress is who decides what the budget is. But this last year, in I think it was either late February or early March, the president comes out with his budget, and he zeroes out the Land and Water Conservation Fund, which is the number one access tool in this country. Well, that was not amenable to us and our membership, and so we held him accountable for that. And, you know, we're pretty loud. 2 weeks later, Senator Daines and Senator Gardner go to him and ask him to, you know, they're both in tough election cycles running against Democratic governors. They're two sitting senators are Republicans. And so they go to him. They could ask him any question they wanted to and say, you know, and what is something he can do for them? Could be about healthcare. Could it be about immigration? Could be about the economy? What they chose to talk to him about was full and dedicated funding for the Land and Water Conservation Fund. What does the president do? A couple days later, even the next day, comes out with a tweet, which he's accustomed to doing and announcing things, and said, if the Congress puts a bill on my desk that will fully dedicate $900 million for the Land and Water Conservation Fund, I will sign it. And so what do? We came out and applauded him. And I will tell you that when we held him accountable 2 weeks prior, there was some, you know, folks that made them nervous. And then 2 weeks later, when we applauded him for saying that he would, you know, sign a bill, there were some people that were nervous about that too. But at the end of the day, you know, again, training a dog, you got to be honest with that dog. When they do something well, you got to applaud them. And when they do something bad, you got to hold them accountable. And I think that, you know, we treat politicians like that. And that, I think, is what ultimately separates us from a lot of sportsman's organizations. And then I also would say that is one of the reasons why we're growing so fast is that people think it's refreshing, to really, I think, have an honest conversation with our elected officials in particular.
I love it. And you're absolutely right. I think that does put you apart from a lot of other organizations. And having been a professional version of that back in the day, I know it works, and so I'm glad to see some organization actually offering carrots plus sticks in the right proportion. And, you know, hey, in our Handle It segment, we've talked about how many praises versus how many corrections in the past. It's absolutely true. Now, if we could only fit them all for electronic collars. All right.
We've joked about that, and it may be effective, but probably illegal.
Yeah. And or sometimes we could just put them out in the backyard with a bowl of water for a couple of days, and that might do it. All right, we've talked all around it. The Land and Water Conservation Fund is a part of, now it's a part of the Great American Outdoors Act, number one. Everybody who worked on that, from the very grassroots listeners out there to the folks at the organizational levels like you, congratulations. Let's talk a little bit about what it is and then what's passed since, because this thing seems to be a work in progress according to some folks, but explain the Great American Outdoors Act to our listeners here at the Upland Nation.
Sure. So it contains two main provisions, and the first one is the Land and Water Conservation Fund, and then the second one is addressing the backlog of maintenance on our public lands. So I'll go back to the Land and Water Conservation Fund first. So this is established in 1964. It was when there was a bunch of oil and gas development happening offshore in the Gulf of Mexico. And the good foresight of folks back then was like, if you're taken away from one resource, let's give back to another. So Land and Water Conservation Fund has been around since, 1964. It's been used in 100% of the counties in America, and it really pays for access and then conservation. And so part of that access is, it pays for 70% of the access or fishing access sites here in Montana. It's helped us get to inaccessible public lands. And also some large purchases that are open for access, but ultimately, provide conservation values as well. And the other part of that of Land and Water Conservation Fund is they provide money for city parks, baseball fields, even some golf courses and pools. And so especially in these small communities that don't have a large tax base, if you look at almost any project that is open to the public within that city, it's usually paid for by the Land and Water Conservation Fund.
And how is that money channeled from the feds down to the city of Redfield, South Dakota, for example?
It's a great question. So depending on the project, right, and there's the money, and I failed to say this before, but it comes up, from this offshore oil and gas development, and it's excise taxes. So this is not taxpayers' dollars. It's something that is in place. And so it's not taking any money away from the taxpayers. But the way that money is distributed, it's distributed in kind of two ways. There's a federal side of that, and federal money is distributed really on the size of your state and the population of your state. So a state like Montana, we do really well on the size of our state, but we have just under a million or about a million people. And so the population, we don't get so well. Oregon, with a large population and a large state, like, you guys score pretty high. And so what happens then is then projects are put forward, usually senators and congressmen then support those projects, and then ultimately they're decided at a federal level by the agencies. Agencies then, they'll go put that money on the ground. The other portion is at a state level, very similar. But when you think about like parks in particular, like at a city and kind of county level, that would really be, I would most likely guess that that's like state-based funding, because that money is much more conducive rather than the federal side, where they're much larger purchases, I would say.
Yeah. All right. So not to discount all the funds that come in from the Pittman-Robertson and Dingell-Johnson money,
sure,
the excise taxes on fishing rods and ammo and guns and related gear like that, which is still a massive funding source for a lot of the same or similar projects. But this, especially the Land Water Conservation Fund, it's a real windfall for hunters and anglers, because that money is now, if I recall, it's a perpetually funded, isn't it?
$900 million a year in perpetuity.
Yeah.
Which is like, that's why this is, Scott, this is probably one of the biggest pieces of legislation that I will see in my lifetime that will benefit not only hunters and anglers, but I would say all Americans.
Great. Unfortunately, since it was passed, signed into law, so it is law, and now, of course, folks are trying to rewrite the law. What's the latest on that?
So I would say, if we can step back for 1 second, like there was also the deferred maintenance piece in there.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Great,
let's
American
do that.
Outdoors Act.
Sure.
And there was, and so, you know, our public lands, whether that's U.S. Forest Service lands, Bureau of Land Management, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they've been chronically underfunded. And that's Congress who decides that. And really, that's led to this backlog of maintenance. So that's toilets, you know, that's roads. That's just basic infrastructure for the people to get out and enjoy our public lands. And so there's estimates anywhere from like $20 to $25 billion of necessary upgrades on our public lands. And so part of this legislation was to address that. And it's $1.9 billion a year for 5 years, which ultimately is $9.5 billion. So about half of what we need to do. But I would say, you know, think about your car. And if you don't do maintenance on your car, you're not doing regular oil checks, you're not, you know, replacing your spark plugs, at some point you're going to have to do a major, major overhaul. And that's kind of where we are right now. We had to buy a new engine for our public lands. And then hopefully as we go forward, we get better, better funding and a consistent level for the management of them. So that's the two pieces. It's super exciting. Again, largest piece of legislation that I've really ever gotten to work on, that will have impacts, you know, for years to come.
Let me ask you this,
go ahead.
Because I've railed on this and written about it in any number of publications in the past, to a great degree, hunters and anglers, are funding all sorts of things that have very little to do with hunting and angling, through those excise taxes that I talked about. Is the Great American Outdoors Act divorced from the Land Water Conservation Fund, the other half of it you just described, the deferred maintenance, that's all coming from taxpayer dollars. Am I correct?
You are not correct.
Okay.
The issue you bring up is absolutely gigantic, but the money for the backlog of maintenance will come off of all new energy developments, whether
there
that's oil and gas,
okay,
or if it's solar or wind, any kind of new energy project, that money will funnel into, again, excise taxes. So it's not, you know, taxpayer dollars.
Okay, great. All the better.
All the better. That said, you know, I mean, and I don't want to distract this, but I think what you bring up as hunters and anglers kind of footing the bill, I think there is a huge opportunity for all of the outdoor recreationists to can start contributing.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that's through a backpack tax or, you know, other things, I think that's absolutely essential as we go forward, but that's a whole nother conversation. But it's an important one.
Someday you and I will team up on that. That'll be my next career, because I've been playing with that issue for a decade. But
that one would be.
I
was going to say that one would be bigger than the Great American Outdoors Act, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And so let's not lose that conversation. But you know, for this, we can move on to
The
tax that you're asking about, right?
So let me remind everybody, you're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I hope you'll keep listening, because I'm learning a hell of a lot here. That's Lan Tawney. He's the president and CEO of the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. You know, just for the record, Lan, give us your website address, because people are going to start poking around. I can almost guarantee it right after this podcast.
So it's backcountryhunters.org. And I would say it's not like we forgot about anglers. It just, that would have made it a much longer piece that you have to put into your browser. So it's just backcountryhunters.org.
Great. Okay. So the Great American Outdoors Act is law. And
yep.
And money is flowing, if it's not, it's starting to. And all of a sudden, there are people who kind of would rather see it changed in one way or another. Why don't you describe all that to us?
Sure. So I go back to the votes in the Senate and the House. So we had 72-25 in the Senate and 310-107 in the House. So overwhelming majorities that this legislation was passed on. Ultimately, the president signs it into law. And so unless you're under a rock in this country right now, like, you are paying attention. Politics has never been more divisive. And, you know, it feels like nobody can agree on anything. Well, what did they agree upon? They agreed upon, you know, the importance of our public lands and our public waters. And I take great solace in that, you know, it's a place for people to come together. And so I put that in the context then of the threats now that are happening right away to the Great American Outdoors Act. And so when you think about the 25 that didn't vote for this legislation, or the 110 I'll tell you kind of, you know, what their thoughts are. So from what I can surmise is these folks just don't like public lands in general. And, you know, it's the Ted Cruz's of the world who's been quoted in tech. You know, he's a senator from Texas who, when asked about, hey, you know, Texas only has 2% public land, what do you think about that? And he said, well, that's 2% too much. You have Senator Mike Lee from Utah, who's a Republican, who has said, you know, it's going to take a long time, but, you know, we will divest these public lands and privatize them. And I'm in for the long haul. You have Rand Paul, you know, from Kentucky, who is against public lands. And so you have some leaders that continue to be just against the idea that the American people own 640 million acres. And so they want to restrict any kind of new public land, and they want to get rid of what we already have. And that, to me, you know, it's short-sighted. It's a slap in the face of the American people and really gets at one of the tenets. Like, I think that, you know, apple pie is very American, though I love huckleberry pie. Baseball is, you know, like our American pastime, but, you know, there's many other sports that are played in this country. I don't think there's anything more American than our public lands. And so I really, these folks fundamentally just don't, don't think that we should have these public lands that are available to everybody. They want to privatize them for themselves or to exploit them.
Now, to be fair, some of these folks are telling us that that states might be better managers of, quote, public, unquote, land than the feds. You know, somebody in the state capital is closer to it than some clown in the beltway over there who's never even been out here. But then again, beyond that, what the states do with some of that stuff, if it ever happened, is already suspect, and who knows what would happen. Am I correct, at least in part, on all of that?
Absolutely. So I think, you know, so there's a couple of things there. I would say that our public land managers, like, you know, yes, there's policies that are made at a federal level that sometimes seem out of touch, but the folks that are on the ground are living in communities, and when they're working on forest plans, or, you know, you're working with your local ranger in the ranger district, his district, those are people that live in the community, and a lot of those decisions, you know, really are being made at a local level. So I would question that. The second piece about, you know, states, you know, we'll take Oregon, for example. Right. So Oregon and the Elliott State Forest. Elliott State Forest has been a place that, you know, has been a great place to hunt elk and black-tailed deer. And it was, you know, school trust lands. And so it has to make money. And they couldn't really make money on that through timber harvest anymore. So they decided they were going to sell that public land. And it took us and Oregon Hunters Association and some others really push back on that to make sure that stayed in public hands. And to me, you know, when you look at a state like Nevada, who has sold 98% of the land that was gifted to them when they became a state, the list goes on and on of states actually selling these lands because they can't afford to manage them. And to me, you know, that, like, while there's great examples, you know, wildlife management areas, you know, here in Montana that I hunt that are absolutely awesome, where wildlife is the priority, that is not the case, you know, on all those state lands. You know, another example would be in Colorado, where not all state lands are open to hunting. Hunters have to lease lands to themselves as public hunters. And we just got the governor to realize that and got another 500,000 acres of additional public land. But it's not, I would say, it's not universally open to the public. And not only is it not open to the public, a lot of times those lands are sold. So a state transfer, I think, is just a smokescreen for ultimate privatization.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so you're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. That's Lan Tawney with the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. So if I recall, there's actually some more specific threats to the Great American Outdoors Act. Can you elaborate on any of that?
Sure. So they're, again, like, you know, these kind of marginalized, I would say, elected officials, majority of them coming out of Utah. There's proposals that say that, you know, there can't be any more public land bought in the West. There is talk about that money being used for the backlog of maintenance instead of being used. I mean, Henley, who is the director of the Bureau of Land Management, just said that earlier this week. when that money is not intended to be spent for that. And again, we have, you know, part of that money from the Great American Outdoors Act is supposed to be used for deferred maintenance, but not the Land and Water Conservation Fund. And so the idea is basically saying that, you know, no more purchases of land in the West, and then let's use that for a backlog of maintenance instead of what the intended purposes are for. So fundamentally changing really how the Land and Water Conservation Fund has operated since 1964 and how it would operate going forward.
You know, I'm working on a magazine piece now for a relatively well-known conservation publication that's all about this acquisition aspect. Can you address that a little bit? For example, don't we already have enough public land in this country? And why should we be acquiring more public land, which comes at the cost of the people who currently own that land?
Sure. So, you know, I would say a couple of things. First is that, and I'm going to tell you about more what I know, but so here in Montana, long tradition of farming and ranching in this state. And, you know, a lot of these ranchers, their kids don't want to take over, or they just want to make sure that that ranch is always going to be the way it is right now. And so they want to either put a conservation easement on it, or they want to gift it to the state or to the federal government so that, again, it stays the way it is right now. And that is their choice as a private property owner. And so I think that, you know, again, where does private property rights stop? Like when we tell them they can't do that, right? On the funding side, I think it's a great question, but it goes back to something I said earlier, is that we have chronically been underfunding our federal land agencies. And like we give them less money now than we did 20 years ago. And percentage wise in particular. And to me, we're just not caring feeding our public land. So this idea that we can't afford anymore, well, sure you can't when you're not, you know, when you're not doing that maintenance that you should be doing in the first place. What I would say about purchasing new land is that, you know, there is 4 million acres of inaccessible public land just here in the West that is either from, you know, checkerboarded or even donated or donutted public land. Mm-hmm. And so part of what the Land and Water Conservation Fund can do is help us either consolidate those lands or gain access to them.
Yeah.
And so that to me, and why is that important? I mean, one thing we haven't talked about today is that, you know, this outdoor economy that is $887 billion a year that is consistent and can grow. That's based, the cornerstone of that is public lands, because that is open to everybody. And to me, if we want to not only maintain that contribution to the economy, and think about some of the small towns, especially as an upland bird hunter, when you're going sage grouse, you know, hunting or sharptail hunting, going out to these small communities, that influx of cash during the fall is like Christmas season for them for like 4 or 5 months. And without these opportunities, you know, and those things go away, that part of the economy goes away as well. And I think that's something that, you know, again, more access, more opportunities is helpful to that outdoor economy in so many ways.
There you have it. That's Land Tawney with the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Backcountryhunters.org is where you learn more about them, even if you're an angler, and so many of us are both, so don't forget that. Land, thanks so much for being a part of the Upland Nation. You've enlightened me in many ways. I've enjoyed this discussion. It's fun to talk about some old friends that we have in common and all that other stuff that's important to so many folks in the world of public policy and public access to public land. More on that at the website, backcountryhunters.org. Land Tawney, thank you so much for joining us for an hour here on the Upland Nation podcast.
Scott, it was my pleasure, and I will leave you with one thing and your listeners with one thing. Is a lot of people in this country don't think their voice counts anymore, and I would say that's the absolute truth if you don't use it. And collectively, together, we can get things done, and we proved that with the Great American Outdoors Act, and let's go find the next fight.
Amen to that. I'll be with you on the front lines, on the ramparts, with sticks and pitchforks and torches. I'll see you there. Thanks again.
Yeah, thanks, Scott.
And, of course, you've still got a lot more to listen to right here. Thanks again, Land, for being a part of this. It's so fun to talk about that stuff in a way that's more concrete. Speaking of concrete, if you want to get out of that and visit some publicly accessible land, then in New York, I'll have some examples for you coming up very soon in our This Land Is Your Land segment. First, let me remind you that Our program is made possible in large part by our sponsors. Gunner Kennels is one of them. Learn more about them at gunner.com. Talked about the 6 million auto accidents that take place every year in this country. If your dog is restrained, then your unsafe behavior will be halved. You'll be safer, your dog will be safer. All of those things are driven home, pardon the pun, at gunner.com, where you can learn about real accidents and real dogs that were saved because they were in Gunner Kennels. Watch the videos, read the stories, take the Fit Finder quiz. You can even crowdsource your fit by asking other people who have the same kind of dogs. It's all at gunner.com. And of course, your dog, whether he's in a gunner kennel or not, ought to be wearing a Dogtra training collar of one sort or another. You'll get 10% off anything over $200. Just use the code SLUN10 at checkout. And another nice thing is any purchase over $200, they'll ship it to you free, and they'll ship it real fast to you. They bring all sorts of good things to the relationship between you and your dog. And like I've said in the past, my collar of choice for training Flick to what I hope will be the highest level, if only I don't screw up. Learn about the free enhanced contact fins for your long-haired dogs in many of the bundles and packages, and on some models separate from the bundles and packages. It's all at Dogtra.com. Yeah, well, we've been talking about this land being your land in the entire Upland Nation podcast today, and I'm so happy for it, because that's where you go, that's where I go, and often we bring our dogs with us. And if you are a grouse hunter in the New York area, northern Pennsylvania, maybe some other states up in that country, you'll appreciate this segment this week, which is brought to you by Huron, South Dakota, where the pheasants outnumber the people. Learn more about all the public access there if you're headed that way at hunthuronsd.com. But if you're not going quite that far afield, there's a chance you can find rough grouse anywhere in New York where there are young managed forests. So if you're learning for the first time to find that kind of stuff, here are a couple places you might at least take a look at. Near Dalton, New York, that's about 80 miles southwest of Buffalo, there is the Rattlesnake Hill Wildlife Management Area. Yeah, there are probably a few rattlesnakes there too. It's about 5,000 acres, so it's a good hunt for a day or two or five, depending on how fast you walk. Very useful place because they are managing it the right way for grouse, among other things. And then in Steuben County, the Irwin Wildlife Management Area, about 5 miles west of the city of Corning. That's only about 2,500 acres, but it again is managed for grouse, among other things. So if you're a grouse hunter in the Northeast, that is one wonderful suggestion, and two incredible places to take a look. All right. So thank you again to all our sponsors who make this possible. I hope you will spend some money with each of them. And also with our newest sponsor, HappyJackInc.com, HappyJackInc.com, all sorts of dog care remedies. They're making all of that stuff, and they've been making it for years and years. They know of what they speak. Once again, hunting dogs were the genesis of the Happy Jack Company. My good friends, Joe and Manning Exum, are carrying on the family tradition. Thank you both for all your wonderful remedies for skin, coat, parasites, fleas, ticks, any need you have for dog care. You'll find it at HappyJackInc.com. And if you heard that message, it's because your hearing is still intact, and I hope it's because you're using hearing protection from ESPAmerica.com, Electronic Shooters Protection America.com. I use mine on the range and in the field, ESPAmerica.com. I hope you learned as much as I did from Lan Tawney about the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Backcountryhunters.org is where you can pick up on the discussion. You can also discuss any of this and more at the Wing Shooting USA and the Upland Nation Facebook pages. Hope you'll subscribe, rate, or review us, especially on Apple Podcasts. I sure appreciate that. It does help. And, in fact, thank you to these folks who reviewed the Upland Nation podcast recently. T. Collins 2, N. Prather, and B. Mystic. Thank you so much for your kind words. I hope to live up to them in the future as well. Speaking of kind, try and be a little bit more so if you can. Be safe. Treat your hunting partners like your dogs, and treat your dogs like your hunting partners, and everybody will be happy. Between now and when we talk next, I hope you get out into the field, and if you do, have a great time. I'll see you there. I'm Scott Linden. Thanks for listening.